Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, Project Blue is back from the dead.
And what a recent court case could mean for Arizona's sex offender registry.
But first, it is awards season, and it's not just books, music, and movies that are being recognized for their cultural impact. Every year since 1990, major language organizations like the American Dialect Society and Merriam-Webster announced their picks for the Word of the Year. As you may have seen, the cryptic phrase 6-7 took the prize from the voters at dictionary.com this year, and other winners have been rolling out steadily over the last few weeks. Stefan Fatsis is a writer who covers the history of language and how we use it. He recently wrote a piece for LitHub about the Word of the Year phenomenon. It was adapted from his book, Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. I spoke with him last week about the very first Word of the Year and how the annual tradition has evolved.
Yeah, that first Word of the Year was bush lips, meaning insincere political rhetoric. It was a reference to George Bush running for president, saying, read my lips, no new taxes,
right.
The elder George Bush.
That word's fairly quick fade in relevance. It prompted this bigger conversation about how a Word of the Year should be chosen and what that choice should reflect. Tell us a little bit about how the debate evolved.
What emerged quickly was this notion that a word to represent an entire year had to have had some traction. The evolution of Word of the Year in the last 35 years has definitely tilted more toward slang and things that have bubbled up on Twitter culture, social media. And these are just part of it's just normal linguistic evolution. The way we think about words changes over time. And social media have certainly had this dramatic effect on the way words are created, spawned, disseminated, and then consumed.
Well, something about this social media context really reminds me of one of my favorite lines from the piece you wrote about this. And the line is, quote, "As a culture, we're forever searching for ways to make sense of our big, complicated, confusing world. Word of the Year neatly boxes up 365 days in a single, simple word. It's media catnip and hot take gold." And one of the things that made me think about is that the Word of the Year, it seems like, has evolved into something that, like, we're because of social media, we're often looking for something to collectively argue about.
Absolutely. I mean, we're always looking for things to argue about, right? I mean, the other parallel I make is it's no different than arguing about who's better, LeBron or Jordan.
Yeah, right.
These sorts of conversations fuel social media.
Yeah.
So what started as this academic exercise, and has continued to be that with the Dialect Society, has sort of morphed into this marketing opportunity for dictionaries now at a time when dictionaries are struggling. And that's all good for business, but I think it's also good for society. Word of the Year is just one more opportunity to dissect who we are as people and where our culture is at any given moment.
So, I mean, as evidenced by bush lips, there has always been a sort of a political valence to the Word of the Year. But there was a shift in the tone of the debate in 2016.
The vote for the 2016 Word of the Year was held in January of 2017 in Austin, Texas, at a linguistics conference, which is where it's held every year. Trump had just been elected to his first term. And the discourse was all Trump all the time. And looking back on this, it's a reminder of just how much language was transformed and dominated by that election. Basket of deplorables, post-truth, alt-right, fake news. There were so many terms that overwhelmed the media conversation. And the winner was dumpster fire, right. And it beat woke. And that vote to me is really interesting because woke was sort of at its peak for its old now meaning progressive, aware, right. Which is how that word evolved from African-American vernacular English. You can date it back into the 1930s with a rise in the 1960s and again in the 90s. And since then, woke has been twisted into a pejorative. And dumpster fire is still just a dumpster fire. So words have these first acts, second acts, third acts.
Well, in the vein of all of this, Stefan, I wonder if we could just step quickly through the Word of the Year selections that have been announced so far. I'd love to get your take on how they fit into what we've been talking about. First, let's go with the Oxford Dictionary has decided to go with ragebait.
Ragebait is content online that's deliberately provocative. And that word fits in with where we are culturally right now, this period of uncertainty and hate and violence. So that sort of threads the needle that a good word of the year should thread. Something that has gained a lot of popularity, and that is, you can prove that by looking at databases, which is what Oxford and other dictionaries do, but it's directly related to where we are as a culture.
Let's move now to the choice by the Macquarie Dictionary. They have decided to go with AI slop.
Yes, that's an Australian dictionary. And if you're going to pick a word of the year, you can't go wrong picking one that is connected to AI because it has dominated the discourse, the sort of non-political discourse. But again, with overlap into politics, because AI is a concern for how conversations are happening online and the reliability of words and the abuse of this new technology. And that's where the slop part comes in.
So next up, we have Cambridge Dictionary, and they have gone with a word that, and I'm curious to know if you disagree with this, but to me felt a couple years out of date, which is parasocial.
Yeah. Parasocial does feel a little bit older, but again, Cambridge says massive increase in lookups for this term. They pegged it to Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, you know, viral characters in our online discourse. What I found interesting about their explanation for parasocial was that it emerged from academia a long time ago. Parasocial dates to 1956, according to Cambridge. Wow. And that's not uncommon with words that have emerged in as important an academic coinage that didn't emerge popularly in culture for decades.
I have to say, one of the other things that's interesting about stepping through all of these choices is there is something kind of neatly boxing up, to borrow your phrasing, of this year, that in a year where AI slop seems like one of the most relevant things to the folks at Macquarie, parasocial is relevant to the folks at Cambridge, AI slop being, you know, fake stuff that is trying to be passed off as real, and parasocial referring to relationships with real people that people feel like they have, but of course, unless they are personal friends with Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift, don't.
It's almost like words of the year should be like a team, because collectively they do a great job of explaining what happened in the last year. Even if individually they might not, you get this nice range that sort of bottles up what we were about for the last 365 days.
Well, for more on the befuddling and fascinating history of words, what they mean, and the role of the dictionary in how we use them, my guest Stefan Fatsis has a whole book about it. It's called Unabridged: The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Stefan, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Sam. Appreciate it.
The controversial Project Blue data center project near Tucson will likely get the go-ahead, even though it's faced intense backlash from the community and was voted down by the Tucson Council earlier this year. The project seemed dead at that point, but now it's back after the Corporation Commission voted last week to approve a plan to let Tucson Electric Power to power the project. But our next guest broke the story that its original operator, Amazon Web Services, pulled out of the plan. Tony Davis is a longtime environmental reporter for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. He spoke with our co-host Lauren Gilger more about the latest.
It definitely looks like it might happen. The Corporation Commission approved an energy sale agreement between them and Tucson Electric Power, the local public utility down here. And that gives the utility the right, the legal right to sell them power, sell them energy to power the huge network of servers that they're going to have for these data centers. And it was very controversial, like everything involving Project Blue. There was dozens of speakers who testified against it, who don't trust Project Blue to keep their promises, and who don't think there's enough strength in the agreement to protect ratepayers in the event AI collapses and Project Blue falls apart. Now, I will add on the side of Project Blue is that they insist that they're not doing an AI set of data centers down there. It's going to be all for cloud computing, but the distrust is still there. And it was a 4-1 vote. There was one dissident, and it was kind of surprised because she's a very conservative person philosophically. But she was grilling them and grilling the TEP people and the Project Blue people with questions, and she wouldn't let go.
So let's back up then and talk about how we got here, right? Because this Project Blue thing has been so controversial in Tucson, and it seemed like not that long ago it had basically been killed because of opposition. So many people speaking out against it at public meetings, et cetera. The city council eventually voted not to allow this data center to use the city's water. How have they changed the plans so that it might happen now?
Well, first of all, it started out like they started out with Project Blue by getting approval from the Pima County Board of Supervisors to sell them 290 acres of land that the county owns to put their data centers. And the County Board of Supervisors also approved the zoning. And the thinking was, and the what the supporters were saying is, it'll be an easy ride for them to get annexed and to get water delivered to them by the city. And as you notice, the city council turned them down, not just turned them down, but turned them down unanimously. But that didn't kill the approval that the county had made for the land sale or for the zoning.
Right.
So they still have the formal right to build there. And so what they did is they did change their plans. Instead of using a data center set that was heavily dependent on water cooling, they switched to air cooling, which doesn't use nearly as much water.
Mm-hmm.
It uses a lot more electricity. But for that, they said they'll just have less computing power for their data centers. So they don't have to get any more energy than what they were already going to get from TEP.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of skated through it.
So this change of plans, Tony, also has to do with why Amazon, which was, you know, all along assumed to be or supposed to be the operator of this big data center, has pulled out. This was Amazon Web Services. You reported they're not going to be the operator involved anymore. Why?
Well, the story that I heard was that Amazon is not comfortable with this air cooling thing. That's just not something they do when they do data centers. And they never talked to me, and I don't know exactly what their thinking was, but that's what several sources told me, the same sources who told me they were pulling out.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to note that Project Blue has never actually confirmed that Amazon was going to be their operating partner.
Right.
And they never confirmed that Amazon pulled out. But at the Corporation Commission hearing, the Project Blue people, they have a company that's getting the development done called Beale Infrastructure. They were asked about this, and all they would say is, we're confident we'll have an operator to run the data centers by the time they're ready to go online in 2027. You know, that what that means is what it seems like right now, they don't have anyone, because if they had somebody, I think they would have said it.
So where does this leave the project? You're reporting now that they're looking for a new operator and that Meta might be interested. Those are unnamed sources telling you that as well. What would be their interest in this?
Well, Meta is big on renewable energy. They say they are. And I think they like the air-cooled data centers because they don't use as much water. But at the hearing on the Corporation Commission, a number of speakers got up and said they'd heard that Meta has already pulled out. Hmm. Now, Meta did not return my emails asking about this, but I heard the same thing from a couple county supervisors. you know, from the tone of the tenor and the tone of the conversation at the Corporation Commission meeting is that Project Blue still does not have someone to operate the place.
Okay.
And they're going to have to hunt. Now, the opponents are all saying, well, we scared them away. We raised so many important questions about this that nobody's going to want to come and do this. That's totally unproven, but it's not completely unreasonable.
Okay, so let me ask you lastly about the renewable energy part of this, right? Like the CorpCom, when they approved this, did pledge to match 100% of the energy used by Project Blue with renewable energy. And as you said, both Beal and, you know, if Meta's potentially interested, they've all said that they want to use renewable energy sources for this kind of thing. What does that kind of scheme look like? How would that function?
I still don't fully know. But TEP had already agreed to build a bunch of renewable energy projects that are just slowly starting to go online now. So I first thought that that's where Beal was going to get a lot of its renewable energy from. But I think that some of that stuff is pledged to other uses. And Beal is going to have to do something called buying renewable energy credits, which means that you pay somebody else to do renewable energy somewhere else, and you can credit that against the non-renewable energy used here. And exactly how that's going to work, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the Corporation Commission, they didn't discuss it. They didn't say how this is going to work. A lot of opponents are very suspicious of this, but we'll just have to see.
Let me ask you, Tony, before I let you go, about the, you know, large number of people who have been very angry about this in the Tucson area. I mean, what are they saying about the fact that even though they put up such a fight, it's probably still going to happen?
They're very depressed and very disheartened by it. They feel like they wanted to get the county to cancel the land sale, and the county said they can't. It's under contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they fought the Corporation Commission. They lost. They're very discouraged, and they're feeling they're not being listened to. And at some of the meetings in Tucson, as many as 1,000 people turned out.
Right.
I've been covering meetings here off and on for, you know, 40 years, and I've never seen 1,000 people at anything or even heard of it since they tried to build a bunch of freeways here in the early 70s. And that's 1,000 people turned out to fight that. But
right.
Since then, nothing like that.
Why do you think this has hit such a nerve?
It's high tech. People are suspicious of high tech. People are nervous about artificial intelligence. They are nervous because of the Colorado River situation. Everybody here is nervous about their water supply.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want somebody else coming in and using a lot of it. You know, there's an anti-development attitude here in this city. It's always been there, but I've never seen it as strong and as articulate and as so many people as for this.
All right, we'll leave it there. And lots to watch for, obviously, going forward. Tony Davis, longtime environmental reporter with the Arizona Daily Star, joining us from Tucson. Tony, thanks for coming back on. Thanks for your reporting here.
You're very welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a recent federal court case challenged laws that require sex offenders to register for life.
Plaintiff is making a plausible argument about how restrictive some of these registry restrictions are, and yet they're not really legally cognizable in the form that he brings here.
We'll hear from a legal expert about why Arizona law might be too restrictive.
But first, Democrats have been critical of Arizona's universal school voucher program since then-Governor Doug Ducey signed it into law in 2022. And while they've tried to scale it back or outright repeal it since, those efforts have gone nowhere in the Republican-controlled legislature. But Attorney General Chris Mays says she may sue State School Superintendent Tom Horn over one way he's handling a portion of the Empowerment Scholarship Account, or ESA, program. Wayne Shutsky from KJZZ's Politics Desk is here now to talk more about this. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So what is Attorney General Mays not happy about?
She's not happy about this policy that Horn adopted about a year ago, where he essentially these voucher expenses that come through his office that have to be approved before a family gets reimbursed, basically anything up to $2,000, they're just automatically reimbursing. Mm. And then they're going to go back and audit them later, they say. Versus how it was done in the past, basically everything that came through was being audited, and that's still happening for those larger purchases.
So in theory, Attorney General Mays is saying that the Education Department should be auditing everything on the front end, as opposed to letting the smaller $2,000 or less purchases go through and then auditing them later?
Yeah, basically saying that by going it later, you know, you're providing more opportunities for things to slip through the cracks. You should basically be approving everything on the front end as has been done in the past.
So why is Horn saying that he's doing it this way?
So last year when he first rolled this out, it essentially was to clear a backlog. So when the state expanded the voucher program from 11,000-ish students to universal, where it, you know, can now apply to anyone, and we're reaching 100,000 students now, they didn't provide really any new funding for more people in the Department of Education to look at those expenses. Mm. And that led to a backlog, Horn said at the time, like a months-long backlog. So essentially you had parents sending in expenses that they wanted to be reimbursed for from these accounts, and then having to wait weeks, months to get reimbursed. So he basically pitched this as a way to clear the backlog and be able to get families their money.
Is it legal the way he's doing it?
He says it is.
I guess the court will ultimately decide.
Yeah, he basically says it's risk-based auditing that is allowed within like the text of the law, and that, you know, that's what they're doing. That basically they're looking at highest risk stuff right away, and then these 2,000 ones, they will go back, and if there is something bad in there, they will go and claw back that money at a later date. Now, Mays makes a different argument, and for a long time now has called on the department and Horn and sent them letters and all these things asking that, demanding that they reverse this policy and take corrective action.
So would Horn, in theory, like to be able to do that if only he had the auditors to actually pull this off?
He hasn't gone that far to say it, but he has definitely said that I need more auditors. Like when he first did this policy, that's what he pointed out. He's like, we don't have enough people here. He's gone to the legislature. He's tried to work with Republican lawmakers to get this done. And unfortunately, it just hasn't happened. Even Mays said she agrees with that his office does need more people to do this. That's part of the solution here. It made it as far as a draft of the budget last year, pushed by House Republicans. But then it wasn't in the final draft that was negotiated by Governor Hobbs and Senate Republicans. So that money's still not there.
Is there a sense of how much fraud the auditors are finding sort of after the fact for these $2,000 or smaller purchases and how much success they're having getting that money back?
I don't have the exact numbers.
Sure.
Horn said he has identified there are instances, yeah, and he's pointed to moments where there's things like whether they were considered luxury purchases, maybe equipment for a student that they could use but maybe was higher end than is required, or even stuff that shouldn't be used at all, jewelry or something like that. He's pointed to instances where we have been able to find that, and we have gone and got that money back. He's also pointed to instances of fraud, or potential fraud. He's referred to the attorney general, you know, calling her a hypocrite, saying, hey, I sent these over to you, and you didn't investigate them or prosecute them. So what's the deal with that? So you kind of have a little back and forth going on here now.
Well, so what is Mays' response to that, that Horn has sent her cases of fraud and she's not prosecuted them?
Her spokesman didn't comment on specific cases, but basically said that every case is reviewed for the likelihood of prosecution, which is the standard that prosecutors, whether it's the attorney general or county attorneys, use. And if we don't prosecute, it's because we don't think there's a likelihood of conviction. Did point out that there's a lot of pending cases, I think like 8 active cases into potential fraud. And we've also had 2 cases that led to either guilty pleas or convictions, which did involve referrals from the Department of Education. So those have already been taken care of. And they're in like the hundreds of thousands of dollars, so not insignificant amount of money, but still kind of a drop in the bucket when we talk about the total cost of this program.
Yeah. Has Mays given any kind of timeline as to when she might decide, yes, I'm going to sue, or no, I'm not?
Not quite yet. These comments came at a press conference that was about something unrelated, but, you know, they always open it up to reporters, and it was actually Craig Harris from 12 News who's been detailing some of these questionable expenses in the program, who asked her about it. And then that's when she confirmed that, yes, litigation is not off the table, was the comment she made. But she did say they're urging Horn to make corrective action to avoid litigation. So she's not, you know, she'd rather he change the policy. However, he hasn't given any indication, barring some change like more auditors or something like that, he would do that, and that he thinks it's legal to do so.
One of the things that seems so interesting is the position that Tom Horn is in right now, right? Because he's getting criticized from the left, from Democrats, for being too, like, not restrictive enough on auditing this stuff. And he's getting criticized on the right. He has a primary challenger from the right who's saying he's being too restrictive on ESAs. Like, this seems like a classic rock and a hard place situation for Tom Horn right now.
That was the phrase I was going to use. Yeah, Tom Horn's been a longtime supporter of the voucher program. So it's not like he he's seen as someone who's trying to rein it in or anything, but he has said that I've taken steps to flag, you know, purchases that are, you know, obviously not allowed. Like I said, some of those luxury items or things that have nothing to do with a child's education. And that has led to some criticism from the right, who basically led by Senator Jake Hoffman, leader of the Freedom Caucus, who are basically saying that Horn is stepping beyond the bounds of what the text of the law says and that he's being too restrictive. And then Hoffman was able to recruit Treasurer Kim Yee to run against Horn. And that was the big cudgel they used when she announced her campaign, is that he's trying to undermine the voucher system. And then, as you said, on the left, they're saying, no, you're not doing enough. You're being too permissive and you're letting, you know, these tax dollars be used wastefully.
Yes. And so it'll be so interesting to watch, I think, into the new year, how that plays out in the campaign. All right. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shusky from the Politics Desk. Wayne, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. A federal judge ruled last month that Arizona's sex offender registry is constitutional. The Arizona Mirror reported on the lawsuit filed by a man who went by John Doe. He'd been convicted of sexual conduct with a minor in 2016. His lawsuit claimed the requirement that he register as a sex offender violated his due process and free speech rights. The suit also tried to do away with the laws that required him to register as a sex offender for life, register his residency in a new county every time he stays there for more than 3 days, and report any online identifiers he uses. Ben McJunkin is an associate professor of law and associate deputy director for the Academy for Justice at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Among other areas of law, he specializes in sex crimes. He joins me to talk more about this issue. And Ben, what about this case and the ruling in it stands out to you?
Well, I think the thing that's most notable about this particular case is that the judge gave sort of short shrift, in my opinion, to a few of the arguments that the plaintiff is raising here. And the reason for that is that mostly there's bad precedent on the books, both Supreme Court precedent and Arizona Supreme Court precedent that have precluded some of these claims. And so I think the plaintiff is making a plausible argument about how restrictive some of these registry restrictions are. And yet they're not really legally cognizable in the form that he brings here. And so the judge is not able to give them the kind of airing that they're probably due.
What to you is maybe a little too restrictive about Arizona law?
Well, so Arizona is not unique necessarily, but it does things differently than some states. And one of the things that it does is that it mandates registration as a result of conviction. So for 22 offenses, there's automatic registration on the sex offender registry. And for most offenders, that's going to be registration for life. And so there's this combination of automatic registration based on your offense combined with the lifetime length of the registration that can make it seem pretty restrictive to people who may have committed even a first offense.
Are there states where somebody who is forced to go on the registry can eventually get off of it?
Yes. Yeah, it is. So it's not uncommon in other states to have places where you can get off the registry. So depending on your risk level, the registration length may vary at the time that it's imposed. Academic commentators, the general academic consensus, I would say, is that you should be able to escape registration, right? The lifetime registration is generally a bad idea and is not justified by risk level. And even if you believe that we should have presumptive lifetime registration, there should be some way for many people to exit registries after a specified period of time and meeting specific conditions.
Why is the consensus that lifetime registration is not a great idea?
Well, I think the real thing is that there's not a lot of evidence that sex offender registries are effective. And there's not a lot of evidence that the recidivism rates are particularly high for sex offenders, especially as they age.
It almost sounds like what you're saying is there maybe ought to be, and in some states there are, like kind of a parole system for sex offenders who are on the registry, that maybe if they meet certain criteria, they can be taken off, like a, you know, somebody who's in prison. There are certain criteria that they can meet. They get paroled and maybe they get out a little early.
That's right. And that sort of brings me to one of the points in this particular lawsuit. So there were five challenges that were brought in this lawsuit. And one of those challenges was what's called a procedural due process claim, where John Doe, in this instance, so he's going by a pseudonym, is suggesting that lifetime registration is simply a violation of the Constitution without some kind of opportunity for an administrative or judicial review that would assess, for instance, whether he's particularly dangerous or whether he has a high risk of recidivism that might justify putting him on the registry.
Yes, but at the same time, I mean, there certainly are places and there certainly are sentences where you have lifetime in prison without the possibility of parole. So I wonder, like, is this just kind of the analog in sex crimes to those crimes?
So that's a great question, and it brings me to another part of the complaint. So it is true that in criminal law, we have certain crimes that might be punishable by life in prison without the possibility of parole. But what's interesting about sex offender registration is that it's ordinarily considered a civil scheme and not technically part of your punishment. And so in this particular case, one of the things that Doe says is that it violates the Eighth Amendment because it's a cruel and unusual punishment, and that it violates the ex post facto clause because the requirements actually change even after you're on the registry. So you might get on the registry when the requirements are relatively light, and then revisions to the statutes might make your requirements more onerous. And both of those challenges get foreclosed by the judge in this case, Judge McNamee, because he says that it's a civil scheme and it's not actually a criminal punitive scheme. And if it's not a punitive scheme, those constitutional protections simply don't apply.
How do you look at the balance in crimes like this in terms of punishing them, and they're particularly sensitive crimes, with the rights of the accused and the rights of the people who have done these crimes to maybe not be punished for them for the rest of their lives, depending on sort of the severity of what it is that they've done?
Yeah, I think it's a really delicate balance. And it's hard to know what side to be on, even as someone who studies this. So some of the things that we know about sex offender registration, one is that it's incredibly popular. And so you're not likely to see politicians or even courts who are going to go and against the grain and cut down registration much, if at all. On the other hand, the best empirical evidence we have is that sex offender registration probably doesn't do much to deter additional sex offenses. And there's at least one plausible theory that it could increase the frequency of recidivism when combined with onerous community notification requirements. And so whether they actually achieve those goals of public safety is a hotly debated question for which we're still continuing to develop the evidence to know. And as a result of that, you know, it's simply hard for us to come out to say where the balance should be struck.
Well, so if the evidence suggests that the registry is not super effective at preventing this kind of crime, are there things that do?
So this is another hotly debated question and probably outside of the scope of what I'm able to answer today. The short version of it is that, you know, we know that the criminal law generally has some important deterrent effect. And so it's certainly the case that in the area of sex crimes, that some amount of prosecution and punishment is appropriate, and appropriate as a deterrence mechanism. But beyond that, there's probably any number of things that we could do, including public health messaging and the way in which, you know, we monitor our kids' online use and things like that, that we could do to keep ourselves safe. That's probably going to be more effective than simply checking the sex offender registry to see if we live near sex offenders. So if you think about sort of the way in which sex offender registries are supposed to operate, there's really two primary benefits. The first benefit is supposed to be that if there's a sex crime, the police know, you know, where the nearby offenders are so that they can investigate them first. And I think because people are on the registry, there's an assumption that they're less likely to reoffend because they think they'll get caught for precisely that reason. And we just don't see that bearing out that much. And then the second purpose of the registry with respect to community notification is that people can take self-precautions, right? They can check the community notification and decide, okay, well, I'm going to avoid the people who are registered sex offenders. But what we know about sex crimes is that, in fact, a large portion of sex crimes are committed by people you know. They're not committed by strangers. And so even if we took added precautions against certain people, we're probably taking the wrong precautions against the wrong people.
All right. That is Ben McJunkin, an associate professor of law and associate deputy director for the Academy for Justice at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Ben, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. As the year comes to an end, we here at the show are looking back at some of our favorite interviews and stories of 2025. We'll continue today with my visit to the Jane Goodall Archive at ASU in October. Earlier that month, the famed primatologist and conservationist died at the age of 91. She's perhaps most famous for her work studying chimpanzees in Gombe National Park in Tanzania. The Jane Goodall Archive sits in a room filled with filing cabinets at the Institute of Human Origins in the Walton Center for Planetary Health building on the Tempe campus. The archive is owned by the Jane Goodall Institute, which continues to fund data collection in Gombe with some help from ASU. Ian Gilby is an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change and a research scientist in the Institute of Human Origins at ASU. He oversees the archive. When I visited recently, we sat at a table surrounded by, as Gilby put it, literally every piece of paper that's ever come out of Gombe National Park in Tanzania, where Jane Goodall did her pioneering chimpanzee work. He also explained how the archive ended up at ASU.
Long story. It's a typical academic story, but in short, my PhD advisor, Ann Pusey, was a student of Jane's in the 70s at Gombe, and she essentially, when Jane famously switched from doing research to focusing on conservation in the 80s, the data were continuing to be collected by Tanzanian field assistants in the at Gombe. So literally every day we've got field assistants out following chimpanzees, systematically collecting data. And these data were piling up in Jane's house in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania because Jane was off saving the world, essentially. And so Anne asked Jane if she could curate and work with the data. And so it moved first to the University of Minnesota. I came on as a graduate student in 1997 with Anne and did my dissertation using the long-term data as well as my own observations at Gombe. And then I went off for various postdocs, and Anne moved to Duke along with the archive, and then she retired in 2019. And we decided that the archive should come to where I am, and which is ASU.
And how is it being used here? Like, how do you use it? How do students who come here use it?
I mean, we use it for many different things, but the main goal is to conduct research on chimpanzee behavioral ecology. These animals live for, 50, 60 years. They reproduce really slowly, and you really need decades worth of data in order to answer some of the questions that we have.
And are you still getting updates? Like, do you still get new data from the field?
Every day, they are collecting the data as we speak. And at the moment, what happens is essentially the data is still collected on paper, and it builds up. And then when one of us goes to the field, we carry it back with us. But we scan it before we travel with it. And one of the things that I'm working on, and I have for a long time, is to streamline this process. So right now we're having some of the data being entered in the field and uploaded to the cloud.
Yeah, I mean, I should note that we are surrounded by a pretty good number of pretty deep filing cabinets. And as you mentioned before we started recording, they are full of paper, all of them. That's a lot to go through. And I would imagine if you're continuing to add on to that, digital might be the easier way to do it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in a perfect world, we'd have our field assistants collect data on tablets in the forest as, the behavior is happening. But for various reasons, mainly practical reasons, it's a tough ask. So what we decided to do was, rather than put our time into that, was to work with AI to extract data from the data sheets themselves.
What appeals to you so much about studying chimpanzees? Like, why are they so interesting to you?
I'm just fundamentally interested in animal behavior. I mean, I didn't end up here because I, you know, have this incredible love for chimps or anything like that. I mean, I do now, but that's not how it started. It started with just a general interest in animal behavior, and in particular, the sort of complicated social relationships that you find in some of these social creatures.
So how did your admiration maybe or appreciation for them evolve? Was it just a matter of doing this kind of work over a certain amount of time?
Pretty much, yeah. I had never been to Africa. I don't think I'd ever even seen a chimp in a zoo. As I said, I was just fascinated with animal behavior, social behavior in general. And so I had the opportunity to do this as a graduate student. And I went to Gombe first in 1999, and it changed my life. And I've gone back basically every year since.
What did you know of Jane Goodall's work before that first trip to Tanzania?
Only as much as the sort of scientifically literate public knew. You know, I'd seen all the documentaries, and I knew the general story, and in particular, you know, her pioneering ideas that animals aren't sort of robots, that they're individuals with personalities and variation in their personalities, and which is obviously, you know, something now it seems very obvious to us all, but you know, back then, you know, animals were thought to be just sort of reactionary beings that didn't really have any personality.
Do you see what you're doing in some ways of continuing her work?
As much as anybody can continue. I mean, I've been asked that before. You know, she can't be replaced. There's no way. I mean, just but her, you know, her work recently, since the mid '80s, had been more conservation based, and you know, essentially saving the planet. And so, in that sense, there's no way we could even begin to continue. So we do our best. We try to build on what she started, essentially.
So why do you think it's important? Like, what do we learn about maybe ourselves? What do we learn about the planet by studying chimpanzees and their behavior and how they interact with each other and themselves?
There are so many reasons why we study chimpanzees. I mean, for me, honestly, it's because I just find them fascinating. But they are a keystone species. So, you know, studying them, saving them saves critical habitat, right? It's been shown that sites with research stations are much more likely to persist than sites that aren't protected in any way. From a planetary perspective, again, understanding how animals interact with their environment and their ecosystem and what's important to them is, you know, regardless of what species it is, it's really important to know. From an anthropological perspective, chimpanzees are one of our two closest living relatives, and so we use them to sort of provide clues to what the behavior of the last common ancestor of humans and apes was like.
What have we learned recently? Like, what kind of research are you and others doing using this data now, and maybe what are some of the things that we're finding out recently?
So some of our recent work, we've looked at the form and function and development of male social bonds. So let's call them friendships. Basically, you have pairs of males who spend a lot of time together, grooming one another all the time, and supporting each other in conflicts with others. And it's, you know, this was one of the things that Jane witnessed early on and suspected that there was some sort of value to these relationships. And now, 65 years later, we're able to test that hypothesis. And sure enough, we found that pairs of males who have strong social bonds are more likely to rise higher in the dominance hierarchy. They're more likely to sire offspring for males of that rank. And these bonds do essentially last for decades.
So when you think about what's in all of these filing cabinets and what's in the scan documents that you have, what do you think about sort of the body of work overall? Like, what comes to mind for you about its significance, its importance, its maybe interest to you and other folks who do what you do?
I mean, this is literally, you know, a unique resource that's unmatched. There are many other very, very strong, very good long-term chimpanzee projects, which I've actually also worked on as well. But this is sort of the iconic original one, the longest running one. So it's symbolic in a way, as well as being incredibly valuable.
Ian Gilby is an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change and a research scientist in the Institute of Human Origins at ASU.
Well, that'll do it for this morning's edition of the show. But Mark, before we go, do you have thoughts on the Jordan LeBron debate?
Both Hall of Famers.
Both. That's a cop out.
How about that for a hot take?
Okay, fair enough. I did look up to see if either of them was 6'7" in terms of height. Unfortunately, no. That would have been too easy.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you for listening this morning. Please remember that you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also follow us on Instagram at kjzztheshow. We'll talk to you again tomorrow morning. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman.